A light wind ripples through the long grass, as nearby the river water gently laps at the banks. No one sees him, but he sees every one of them. He watches them as they laugh, and she affectionately touches his cheek. He sees them as they kiss. Behind the eyes, peering out of the grass, is a mind that has turned on itself. And that betrayal is about to have deadly consequences. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 194, The Serial Crimes of Themba Sekude. I am stealing my own ad spot this week to tell you about my new book, Bare Bones, Cold Cases from True Crime South Africa, that has just hit the shelves. It's my fourth book, and the first which focuses specifically on cases I've covered on the podcast. In the book, I explore 10 of the unsolved cases you've heard on the pod. I give you background to my research around the cases, and I share everything that happened after I switched the mic off and published the episode. From reopened cases to new leads and witnesses. If you've ever wondered what happened to that case, Bare Bones gives you everything you need to know. Bare Bones is available in all bookstores in South Africa in paperback, in ebook format on Amazon, and I'm in the process of recording the audiobook. I have a book launch for Bare Bones in Cape Town on the 6th of October. Check out Exclusive Books website for more information, and we're planning one in Johannesburg too, probably in November. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Carleen van Skalkfake, Khomotso Motlong, Mark Koklo, and MJ for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. I really do appreciate your support. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. I'm always fascinated by how different serial murderers can be from one series to another. We often think about this type of crime as being very formulaic, and I won't go into my usual spiel about how different South African serial killers are from other countries' serial killers. Well, not now at least. But besides that part, I feel like in general we have lots of assumptions we make about the way serial murderers operate. How they choose their victims and their modus operandi, and very often, when we look at the reality of it, those assumptions aren't true. Yes, there are things that we've learned that often apply to many serial murderers. I'm not saying the research is meaningless, but also I think we, and by we, maybe I just mean me, need to stop being quite as surprised when they don't behave the way we expect them to, more often than not. So with that in mind, let's get into episode 194, The Serial Crimes of Themba Sekude.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Newcastle is the third largest city in the KwaZulu-Natal province of South Africa. Set at the foothills of the northern Drakensberg Mountains, Newcastle is located in the northwest corner of the province along the Nkandu River. Newcastle has changed names several times throughout its history. In the 1840s, it was called, quite unoriginally, the Post Holt No. 2, because it was the second place horse-drawn postal coaches stopped on the journey between Durban and Johannesburg. Funny enough, it's still a place many families stop over in doing that same journey, albeit no longer with horses. Between the 1840s and the 1890s, Newcastle changed names twice more. It was named Waterfall River Township, and then when the British moved in, it was given the name Newcastle after the Duke of Newcastle, who was the British colonial secretary at the time. But in 1899, during the Anglo-Boer War, when the Boer forces took over the town, they renamed it Viljoensdorp, after one of their generals, Ben Viljoen. When the British eventually reclaimed the town, it changed back to Newcastle, as it remains today. Despite these various name changes, one thing about Newcastle has never changed. It was always a very important location for the area that surrounded it. When coal was discovered in the town in the early 1900s, it became an industrialised hub. And today, it's the main commercial and industrial centre in northern KwaZulu-Natal. A site within Newcastle, which had been created to provide residents with a place for outdoor recreation, Trim Park, located north of the CBD along the Nkandu River, has over the years often veered down into a condition of disrepair, which is not uncommon if such facilities aren't kept up. Around the time that this case happened, it was seen as relatively safe, but also not somewhere you'd go alone at night, for instance, if any such place still exists. With Trim Park being along the river, large parts of the park alongside the river had become very overgrown with long grass. Grass so long that in places it was taller than an adult man. And on Valentine's Day 2004, Trim Park would see the first in a series of incidents which would turn this well-used recreation area into a hunting ground for a serial killer. Before I get into the crimes related to the series, please do note that I have changed the names of the rape survivors to maintain their anonymity, even though their real names are available in the court judgment. On the 14th of February 2004, 16-year-old Lesedi had gone to Trim Park with her boyfriend, Veli Ngamo. It was around 6 p.m. when they arrived, and although the sun was starting to go down, there was still enough light around. The area itself was also quite well lit with streetlights, even after dark. The couple, however, didn't intend to spend very much time in the park. They really just wanted some time alone before Veli took Lesedi home. The couple sat and chatted for a while and then started to become intimate. Lesedi would later explain how she'd suddenly become aware of Veli falling on top of her, and she realized that there was a man standing over them, and he had just struck her boyfriend on the head with a very large rock. The man proceeded to pull Veli off Lesedi and threw him to the side. Lesedi was terrified that he was about to do the same to her, and as he reached for her, she started to fight back. He slapped her across the face, and she froze in terror. Veli was not moving, but the man lifted the rock in the air again. It was so large that he had to use both hands, and then he let it fall down onto Veli's head a second time. He then grabbed Lesedi and began to drag her away. She started to scream, and the man pulled a knife out of his pocket and told her that if she didn't shut up, he would slit her throat. Terrified and equally concerned about Veli, Lesedi stopped screaming. The man threw Lesedi into a ditch where he raped her before telling her to get dressed and leave. The young girl did not need to be told twice, and as she gathered her clothing, she noted the severe injuries to her boyfriend's head from the rock. She was sure Veli was dead, and if she didn't get out of there, she would be too. Without looking back, Lesedi ran as fast as her shaking legs could carry her and burst into the first shop she found open, a nearby takeaway. their shocked customers and staff tried to comfort the hysterical girl and called police. Around 8:30 p.m. that night, Constable Hendrik Becker arrived at the takeaway outlet and took an initial statement from Lissetti. She directed him to the scene at Trim Park, and there Constable Becker found the body of Veli Ngamo. The young man had serious head wounds and was sadly already deceased. Nothing appeared to have been stolen from the scene, and the large rock Lissetti pointed out as having been the murder weapon was found about a metre from Veli's body. Even when Becker arrived on the scene, it was well lit, and so when Lissetti said that she had clearly seen her attacker's face, he didn't doubt that she had. The young girl said that while the man was raping her, she had distracted herself from the horror by forcing herself to study the man's face. She described his features in detail and said that if she saw him again, she would definitely be able to identify him. Becker had taken Lissetti to the hospital for a checkup and rape kit to be taken. Unfortunately, no DNA sample from a perpetrator was present in the swabs taken. Then, Lissetti sat with a forensic artist to draw up an identikit of the man who had raped her and killed Veli. As Lissetti had finally been allowed to return home and try to start working through the deep trauma she'd endured, she likely hoped that police would soon have the man in custody. There must have been an undeniable sense of fear that the man would come back to silence her, especially once the media started to circulate the identikit and he realised she could identify him. But Lissetti would have to learn to live with both her trauma and that fear, because it would be quite some time before her attacker would be behind bars, and before then, he still had quite a few victims in store for Newcastle. In all fairness, there was very little to go on in this first case. No cell phones had been taken which could be tracked, the perpetrator was not known to the victims, and there was no DNA from the rape. There was an excellent identikit, but even months after that was published, no one came forward to say they recognised the man. Then, on the 27th of October 2004, taxi driver Teboho Mthethwa completed his shift and swung around in his taxi to collect his girlfriend, Amatle, for a date. The couple drove to Trim Park, where Teboho laid out a blanket and pulled some drinks from a cooler in his vehicle. They sat sipping the drinks and chatting for a while, and then began to have sex. Amatle later said that she noticed a man walking up to them, and before she could alert Teboho to his presence, she saw a large rock falling toward them. The rock landed squarely on Teboho's head, and he was knocked unconscious immediately. The man pulled Teboho off Amatle and once again struck him with the rock. This time, bile rose up in Amatle's throat as she saw the blood coming from her boyfriend's head and realized he could not have survived that blow. She immediately began to beg the man for mercy and asked him if she could please get dressed. He told her not to get dressed and instead held a knife to her throat and forced her to walk with him closer to the river. There he raped Amatle and then forced her back toward the vehicle. The man pulled the car keys out of Taboko's pocket and unlocked the taxi, and for a horrifying moment, Amatle thought that he was going to abduct her in the vehicle. She took the opportunity while his back was turned to get dressed, and when she looked again, she noticed that there was a fire inside the vehicle. The man had set the upholstery in the middle console alight, and he watched as it burned. With little other fuel for the fire, it soon burned out. But it was a random destructive action that no one could ever really figure out. He then turned to Amatle and demanded to know where the gun was. She had no idea what he was talking about, and she told him as much. Over and again, he grabbed at Amatle's arms, demanding to know where the gun was. but there was no gun. And she told him that over and again until he eventually seemed to give up. Finally, the man rummaged through Amatle's purse and took some money out. And then he ran away. Amatle had set off in the opposite direction. She ran until she reached the main road and flagged down a taxi driver who called police for her. In the hours that followed, police returned to the scene with Amatle and found Teboho deceased from severe blunt force injury to his head. The large rock covered in his blood was still lying near his body. It seemed that after Amatle had run away, the killer had returned, because when she asked the police officer to check for her and Taboko's cell phone in the cubbyhole, they were no longer there. After pointing out what had happened where, Amatle was transported to the hospital for a rape kit. Unfortunately, again, no DNA profiles were recovered in the kit. She then gave her statements to police, along with a detailed description of the offender. With the cell phones taken in this case, that may have been an opportunity to track the offender, but they were switched off. And although investigators would occasionally check back to see whether they were active once again, nothing came of that vein of the investigation. With two identical incidents in the same location within a few months of each other, the media almost immediately started to question whether Newcastle had a serial killer in its midst. Just a month after the murder of Teboho Mthethwa and the rape of his partner, Amatle, Trim Park was the scene of yet another murder. This time, we have no information about how the murder actually happened, because the victim would be found by a passerby. On the 26th of November 2004, just a few metres from where Teboho and Amatle had been attacked, the body of a young man was discovered. Nkosinathi Shabalala had been on his way to work that Friday morning when he stumbled across the man. The victim was naked from the waist down, and he'd sustained severe head injuries. Not far from his body lay a rock, splattered in blood. Sadly, this victim would never be identified. And although it was impossible to say for sure whether the man had been engaged in sex when he'd been killed, like the other victims, or if the killer had taken his pants off, from the location, the weapon used, and the distinct similarities to the other incidents, it seemed like a fair assumption that there had been a female victim involved too. But no one ever came forward to confirm that they were with the man that night, despite police pleas for them to do so through the media. It's possible the woman was just too scared to do so, considering the killer and her possible rapist was still on the run. Or perhaps it was a sex work transaction between the victim and the woman, and that was what made her hesitant to come forward. Either way, the mystery of the deceased man in the park so soon after the last murder ramped up the speculation around a serial killer. Police announced that they were offering a 15,000 rand reward for information which could lead to the arrest of the offender. Trim Park's reputation was severely dented, and locals for the most part steered clear after dark. Thankfully, the Christmas season passed without event, and this is something I've spoken about in other serial murderer episodes, where these individuals often seem to stop killing over this period. Whether it's because they themselves are off enjoying a break, or perhaps they're visiting family in another province, it's a trend I've seen time and again. Often, if there's a murder in a series in November, then the next one is in January. And that is exactly what happened here. On the 7th of January 2005, Dunpalin Govender was visiting his sister and her husband in Newcastle. He was supposed to sleep over there that night, but his sister and her husband began to argue, so Dunpalin decided to leave. It would be a deadly decision. His family believe that he had been headed home that night and seemed to have taken a shortcut straight through Trim Park. On the morning of the 8th of January 2005, Peter Janssen van Vieren was taking a morning walk through the park when he came across Dunpal and Govinda lying on the ground. There was a rock with blood on it nearby, and the young man had also sustained head injuries. There was also a roll of 100 rand notes laying near his head. Jansen van Vuren leaned in to check whether the young man was alive and felt a weak pulse. Although unconscious, Dunpalin was still clinging to life. Paramedics and police were called, and the young man was rushed to hospital. Sadly, although he had clung on as long as he could, Dunpalin passed away in hospital 2 days later. Unfortunately, he had never regained consciousness and could not share what had happened on the night of the attack. Newcastle police strongly believed that he had just become the fourth murder victim of a serial killer they were now desperate to catch. A few things about Dunpalin's murder made it different from the others. His race was one aspect. Dunpalin was a South African man of Indian heritage, whereas all the other victims were black. While we do see serial killers often sticking to only one race group in places like the US, that's actually less common in South Africa. Here, it seems our serials just go after the victims that are available and vulnerable at the time. It was clear that this killer was specifically using Trim Park as his hunting ground, and therefore anyone of any race or sex was within his target pool as long as they were in his location of choice. The other thing that made this murder different was the lack of at least an apparent sexual element. The young man was fully clothed when he was found, although he was missing his shoes. There was no clear sign that he'd been about to engage in sex. His pants were on, belt fastened and zip up. It's entirely possible the killer just didn't really care and saw a victim and decided to go for it. But there was that wad of money lying next to his body. Either the killer didn't see it, or really wasn't that concerned about stealing. But from his actions at Amatle and Taboko scene, I don't see that being true. So it's possible that he just hadn't noticed it. I do wonder, though, if the killer was interrupted at the scene. He'd been so sure to kill the other victims, but Dunpalin was left alive, although admittedly only barely. And if the killer had had as much time at this scene as he had at the others, surely he would have found that cash and taken it. It's also the presence of the cash that makes me wonder. Why was it out of Dunpalin's pocket? Had he been in the act of pulling a few notes from the bundle when he was attacked? Had that perhaps been to pay for a possible sex act? Of course, I don't wish to besmirch the victim's memory in any way by making such a suggestion. It's merely a thought I had. And again, a sex worker may be less likely to go to the police. Had a woman managed to escape the killer because they were not yet engaged in the sex act? And had the killer been concerned that she would alert others so he hadn't struck Dunpalin again and hadn't grabbed the money, just fleeing in fear of getting caught? It's a possible scenario, I guess. But either way, from the timeline of the various cases, it was clear that the serial murderer was escalating. After the third murder, all of the cases had been handed over to an experienced murder detective from the Murder and Robbery Unit. Although police weren't saying so publicly, by doing this, it was clear that they also acknowledged that they had a serial murderer on their hands. The investigating officer in question had not yet been trained in the specific investigation of these types of series, though. But he was an excellent and experienced detective. Had he already been through that training, though, and had the investigative psychology unit been brought in at that point, the geography of the murders may have been studied a little better, and the profile of exactly what that meant for where the serial killer may be living or working could have led to an earlier arrest. Today we know that serial killers tend to kill in areas that are familiar to them. That familiarity doesn't necessarily mean that they live there. It could be where they work, or where their childhood home is, or where a very good friend they spend a lot of time with lives. There is even software today that, after inputting all of the scene locations, can give investigators exact areas to include in their investigations. Back then, though, it doesn't even seem as though the whole of the park was ever searched. Or perhaps only the common areas where the grass was trimmed and people would walk were checked. And of course, no one was living there, right? But there was that very long grass. Remember, the untended to grass that grew in places even taller than most people, close to the river, where the land was lush and fertile. Well, it seems that no one sought to check there. It was the perfect place, really. Completely hidden from view, yet someone in there could gaze out without being seen and observe the comings and goings of people in the park. And they could emerge quietly and go back in just as easily. The perfect natural veil. And beyond that green veil lay the lair of a predator. Junior Sithole was almost 70 years old when he got unwittingly pulled into this case. He lived in an informal settlement in Newcastle and made money by collecting metal scrap, like tin cans, from dustbins and selling them back to recycling centres. It was long, hot, back-breaking work, but it was all the man knew, and it was honest work. On the 2nd of March 2005, Junior was out collecting his items, as he did every couple of days, when he stopped on the side of the road for a drink and a rest. As he did, a man walked up to him and asked whether he had a light for a cigarette for him. Junior pulled a box of matches out of his pocket and handed them over to the man, who lit a cigarette, and handed back the matches. He then settled down next to Junior to smoke. Junior offered him a sip of his drink, and they sat chatting for a while. The man asked Junior what he was doing that day, and he explained what he did for work and returned the question. The man said that he didn't really have a formal job, but he worked in the park. Junior didn't quite understand what he meant, although he knew he meant Trim Park, of course. The stranger went on to explain how he looked out for couples who were having sex in the park, and he attacked them. He said he would usually kill the man by hitting his head with a rock, and then, as he put it, he'd have sex, i.e. rape, the women. He explained that he robbed them after this, and that was how he got items to sell for money. Junior was understandably shocked, and although he had no idea whether the man was telling the truth or not, he had heard about some incidents that had happened in the park. Junior told the stranger he needed to continue with his work and walked away from him, doing his absolute best to act nonchalant about the completely insane information he'd just been given. The stranger said goodbye and they parted ways. As soon as Junior was out of sight of the man, he started running as quickly as his legs would carry him to the home of a friend of his, who he knew had a cell phone. When he arrived there, he explained the situation to his friend, and both men went to look for the odd stranger. Their plan was that as soon as they had him in their sights, they'd call police, so they could come through and hopefully arrest him. It would take almost another week for Junior and his friend to spot the man. But on the 8th of March 2005, they saw him coming down a narrow path from the river. The two men signalled to one another and hung back, pretending they were chatting and having a rest until the man walked past. They then slowly followed him, keeping him in sight while Junior's friend called police on his cell phone. Inspector Henry Mchali received a radio call that day from dispatch at SAPS Newcastle telling him that residents had had sight of a man who had confessed to being the Trim Park killer. He responded immediately to the location Junior and his friend had given, and they pointed out the man to Inspector Mchali. And that dear listener, is how a dangerous serial killer was caught. Not through smart detection skills, not through fancy profiles or DNA, but very simply through the man's own ego and loose lips, awareness created by the media of the murders, and one honest and determined citizen who did not want to share his neighborhood with a man who would even pretend to be a killer and rapist. The stranger identified himself to Inspector Mchali as Themba Sukude. Sukude was 30 years old when he was arrested, which fits exactly within the range that most experts have concluded serial killers usually start their first series of murders. Sukude had grown up in KwaZulu-Natal and had left school in grade 5. Although he told Junior Sithole that he was not employed, it emerged that he actually did have a job as a manual labourer and earned 40 rand per day. Sukude had a string of prior convictions, but unfortunately none of the details of those convictions were made public, likely because they all dated back more than a decade. Sukude had 2 children who were 8 and 3 years old, but it didn't appear that he'd lived with the children or their mother for quite some time. When Mchali explained why he was placing him under arrest, Sukude denied any involvement in the crimes. Mchali said that that was fine, but he was going to be taking him in anyway, and if it turned out he wasn't their killer, of course he'd be released. The next few hours was a flurry of activity. The 2 rape survivors who'd remembered their attacker's face so clearly were called in for identity parades. Both quickly identified Sukude as the killer without hesitation. Junior's statement was taken, and the information contained in it was so specific that police were certain only the killer would have known the information. Of course, police had to consider whether Junior himself could have been the killer and trying to point suspicion away from himself, but the man was simply far too old to be their perpetrator. Although he was still fit from all the walking he did, he didn't have the strength to be able to lift the rocks that had killed the men, and the 2 witnesses had never seen him in their lives. Despite the evidence building up against him, Themba Sukude continued to profess his innocence. He did agree to show police where he lived, though, although later he would claim it actually wasn't his place of residence, and when police saw it, they realised that he'd probably have been able to watch them at each of the scenes from where he lived. Sukude had set up an old tent in the long grass. It was deep enough in that it was not at all visible from the outside, but it was clear that he had been living there. There was old food scattered around, and interestingly, several items of women's clothing. None of the known victims had reported their clothing having been stolen, so this made police wonder whether there were other victims that they didn't know about. Sukude, of course, was not telling. It was at this point that the IPU was called in, because, of course, they now knew that Sukude was a serial killer, but also they wanted to try and build up as much evidence as possible because they didn't have DNA or any of the victims' belongings in Sukude's possession. Dr. Gerard Labuschagne, who was the head of the IPU at that time, would interview Themba Sukude, but because the man was claiming his innocence, there wasn't really much he could get out of him. He did, however, set about working on a linkage analysis. You'll remember me talking about how a linkage analysis was put to use in one of the first instances in the Quarry murder series in episode 69. Well, that was around this very same time. But in that court case, it was officially acknowledged as having been helpful in proving the case, while in this one, as you'll hear later, although it was important, the judge did not officially acknowledge it in their eventual judgment. And the difference is that when something is acknowledged by a judge in their judgment or sentencing, it's far easier to then use that case law to support future instances. So while the Quarry case is the one where linkage analysis became an official case reference, This case is actually where it was first used in South Africa. So what is a linkage analysis? In this context, it's when a qualified person, such as Dr. Gerard Labaskagni, does an analysis of the various cases presented to him. He then assesses those cases against the research and data built up around serial offenders, specifically in South Africa, but also across the world, and compares the cases to find if there are similarities between them, which might speak to those offences having been committed by the same offender. Now, very importantly, the linkage analysis does not point to a specific offender as being the guilty party. Rather, it links the cases together and says that all of those crimes were more than likely committed by the same offender, and then it is the prosecution's job to conclusively link at least one or more of those cases to the offender in question, specifically. So linkage analyses are really good for cases where, for instance, you have solid evidence for two murders, but more circumstantial evidence for the rest, because the prosecution can then link those two without a doubt to the specific accused, and the linkage analysis comes in to say, well, if they are guilty of those two, then they are also guilty of the rest. This becomes very important when you may only have solid evidence for one murder, for instance, but you know for sure that this person is a serial offender, because the sentencing and eventual parole considerations for a serial offender are going to be very different from someone who is sentenced for a single, seemingly one-off murder. If we know that this is an incredibly dangerous serial offender, we want to keep them incarcerated for as long as possible. And so we need to prove to the court that they are in fact a serial offender, so that can be recorded, not just in their sentence, but also remain in their file, hopefully, going forward to an eventual parole consideration. Parole for someone who committed a mass murder, for instance, where several people are killed at one time, will often be considered differently among the board and around risk factors than a serial killer who has murdered people and made that decision over and over again with breaks in between to reconsider and stop themselves. And we can probably have a conversation one day about the difference in psychology between mass murderers and serial murderers, because there is definitely a difference there. And as far as I'm concerned, depending on the circumstances, there's also a difference in the possibility of rehabilitation. But when you have a serial killer, it is key to protecting the public to get them behind bars as long as possible. One day I'll be doing a revisiting of the Station Strangler series. But that is actually a perfect example of this. Norman Simons, who was believed to be the so-called Station Strangler, was paroled in 2023. And the public, who weren't familiar with the minutiae of the case, were horrified. But legally, Simons was only found guilty of one murder, regardless of how many others he was suspected of. Now, there were certainly similarities between the victim he was convicted of murdering and the others he was not convicted of. So if a tool like a linkage analysis was available back then and could draw links between the cases, it may have been possible to convict him of other crimes through this tool. Like I said, I'll talk more about that case in a revisiting of it at some point. But I really feel it needs a serious deep dive. But that is the result of an individual who was suspected to be a serial murderer only being convicted of one crime, regardless of my or your opinion on that very specific case. In general, it's not good enough to just get someone behind bars for one murder if they've definitely committed more. And we've learned that the hard way over the decades of doing just that and having these unrehabilitated or perhaps unrehabilitatable individuals getting back out and continuing on with their crimes. Even the definition of what a serial killer is was changed by the FBI in the US and is generally applied in most places now, from 3 murders down to 2, to accommodate this very aspect and be able to properly sentence individuals with serial murder tendencies. So this is the role that Dr. Labuschagne and the IPU and linkage analysis played in the trial of Themba Sekude, which started toward the end of 2005 and stretched into 2006. Sekude pled not guilty to all the charges against him, which included 4 counts of murder, 2 counts of rape, 2 counts of robbery with aggravating circumstances, and 1 count of malicious damage to property. His plea statement made it clear that his defense was very simply, "It wasn't me. Prove that it was." Prosecution's witnesses included the 2 rape survivors, who were unfortunately the main focus of the defense's cross-examination, because they had identified Themba Sekude as the man who had raped them and murdered their partners. While the woman gave excellent and clear testimony in difficult circumstances, which did match up with their initial statements, the defense grabbed at several elements in an attempt to discredit their testimony. It was alleged that Amatle had only claimed that she'd seen her attacker's face because she'd actually seen Lesedi's description in the media and had just followed what she'd said. They also claimed that the women had been drunk. There was absolutely no evidence of that. And Sekude claimed that in the lineup in which he'd been identified, he was the only one in the room wearing leg shackles, and that is why he'd been selected. Both women denied that they'd seen any leg shackles on the man, and later evidence would be given by police officers involved in the lineup, which included photographs of the lineup, showing that Sekude's shackles had been covered, and that the view the woman had did not show any difference between any of the men. Junior Sitole was another witness that the defense hammered back at quite hard. He too was accused of having been drunk on the day he claimed to have received Sekude's confession. The defense also claimed that he was only trying to pin the blame on him so that he could receive the reward. Upon hearing this on the stand, Junior seemed confused and asked the lawyer to explain what he meant. He hadn't even known that there was a 15,000 rand reward available for the information. Interestingly, in South African law, Sekude's confession to Sitole could be used as evidence, because Sitole was not a police officer. Confessions are only admissible if they're given to a magistrate, or in some cases, a police officer of a high rank who has no involvement in the case. I unfortunately was not able to find any information about whether Junior Sitole was actually given the reward, but I truly hope that he was. The police officers who had gone with Sekude to his tent were also the subject of intense cross-examination, with Sekude claiming that it was not his tent he'd taken them to, but one of his friends, and the police hadn't asked to see where he lived, but just asked if he knew of any dwellings in Trim Park. The police officers, of course, denied this, and really, Sekude's claim did not make any sense. It was clear that the dwelling had been abandoned for approximately the same time that Sekude had been in custody when he took police there, because there was food that had started to rot. And it also didn't make sense that he would know about someone else's home when he in fact claimed to live somewhere else in a nearby informal settlement. In addition to this, the original arresting officer would testify that Sekude had told him that he lived in the grass by the river when he was first taken into custody. Most important of all, the investigating officer testified that no more murders had happened since Themba Sekude had been taken into custody. Interestingly, when Dr. Labuschagne took the stand to present his linkage analysis, defense counsel did not attempt to cross-examine him or dispute the evidence at all. In their minds, Labuschagne was linking the crimes together, and that was of no consequence to them, because he was not claiming that Sekude was the perpetrator. But really, they absolutely should have at least attempted to refute some of that, as their failure to do so provided the court with the impression that they did not disagree. And when it came down to the judgment, if the judge found him guilty of the two crimes in which there was significant evidence against him, he would then be judged as also guilty of the other two by virtue of the linkage analysis. If he'd gone against it, at the very least, the judge may have had to consider whether there was enough doubt that he was definitely guilty. But Dr. Labuschagne's evidence went unopposed, and thus was considered common cause. The resulting judgment handed down in April 2006 was guilty on all charges, and the judge went on to present a scathing sentencing remark, saying, quote, "The crimes you committed were savage and brutal. The manner in which you killed these four men was cruel and gave them no chance whatsoever. Your intention was to kill them, and you did so in a way that revolts in the extreme. Your behavior was no better than that of an animal. You left the two women you raped traumatized and inevitably scarred for life, not only through the trauma of being raped by you, but the ghastly events that preceded the rapes. You have shown, by the nature of these crimes, that you have no respect whatsoever for human life. You are a menace to society and a serial killer, and I conclude that the prospects for your rehabilitation are zero. In my view, you should be taken out of circulation permanently, and the Department of Correctional Services must kindly comply when I say taken out of society permanently." End quote. And with that, Sekude was handed down not four, but five life sentences. Four for the murders, and one for the rape of Lesedi, because she was a minor when he raped her. For a Matle's rape, he received 10 years, and a combined additional 26 years for the other charges. Because he'd received life, though, all would be served concurrently. And although he was sentenced after the Van Wyk judgment was passed in 2004, it was so close to that he very likely would still benefit from it, and he will probably be eligible for parole as early as next year, 2026. As for the judge's remarks about him being taken out of society permanently, as I've mentioned in other episodes, although this type of remark should go on to offenders' files and carry through to an eventual parole board one day, there is absolutely no guarantee that this will happen. The judiciary does not have any say in what happens after an offender is handed over to the custody of the Department of Correctional Services, unless there is a dangerous offender determination handed down. So a judge saying in their sentencing that he should never be let out does not really have any legal implication. I do really hope that this was explained to the survivors and the victims' families, because I have seen far too many families take this kind of remark by a judge as a decree, and no one explains to them what the reality is until they're contacted 20 or 25 years later, if they're lucky, to be told that the offender is eligible for parole. It is a horrific experience for someone who has moved forward with their life under the assumption that a rapist and murderer will never see the light of day again, to suddenly have that ripped away from them. While I understand why judges do this, I also really wish they would include a bit more explanation for the victim's present to avoid future re-traumatization. There's a couple of things that I haven't yet mentioned that stood out for me in this series. The first was that Themba Sekude was armed with a knife, but he chose not to stab his victims, and instead elected to use a more distant and immediately impactful weapon in the rocks he found in the park. Now that we know he actually lived in the park, it makes more sense that these rocks would be available to him. And I wonder whether he didn't perhaps spend some time looking for them and positioning them in various areas in the park where he could access them when victims arrived. The blitz attack method Sekude used is actually quite uncommon for South African serial killers, where most will use a lure, usually a job offer, to get their victims to go with them. I also thought about Sekude demanding a gun from the second set of victims. I think he'd assumed Teboho would have one because he was a taxi driver. Perhaps he had a generalized view of taxi drivers or had heard that they carried them for protection. But his committed insistence to it being handed over was interesting to me, because it seemed he realized that with a firearm, he would be far more efficient, if you will, as a killer, than with a rock. The crimes in question here are actually quite similar to an unsolved series in the US called the Zodiac Murders, where young couples were targeted while parked for some alone time. But in that series, the killer used a gun. Very few South African serial murderers ever use guns, unless they've managed to get their hands on one by chance. Honestly, I shudder to think how many more murders would have occurred if Sekude had got his hands on a gun that day. We don't know much about Sekude's childhood at all, but without getting too Freudian, it would be interesting to know what his relationship with his father was like, or if there was any abuse from male figures toward him as a child. While it's difficult to really judge what his motive was, his lethal violence was directed solely at the men. So either he approached couples because he wanted to kill the men and saw raping the women almost as an opportunity that presented itself, or his entire goal was just to rape the women. But if so, he could have just targeted women on their own. I think perhaps that the exact combination of a man with a woman already engaged in a sex act and his then complete domination over the man through violence and eventually death in order to take the woman he'd been having sex with was likely part of what drove him. It does make me wonder, though, if he'd started by raping women on their own, and that's where all the clothing came from that was in his tent. Perhaps he quickly figured out that the act of rape alone was not satisfying enough for him from a psychological perspective. From his home in the grass, he would likely have seen many couples pull up and spend time together in Trim Park. And maybe, as he watched, the fantasy took root. I guess we can talk ourselves in circles about the whys and the what-ifs, but the truth will only come from Sekude himself if one day he decides to tell it. And perhaps all of that really doesn't matter, because none of it will undo what has been done. None of it will bring back four young men to their families, to whom they meant everything. None of it will reverse the trauma in the lives of Amatle and Lesedi, and perhaps other women he targeted. As much as we analyse the data and how he compares and applaud advances in case law and long sentences, none of it really changes the absolute pointlessness of it all. The complete waste of human life, both for the victims and their killer. Veli ngamo, Teboho Mthethwa, Dunpalin Govinda, and the unidentified victim. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.